Welcome to the unit on privacy, confidentiality, and security. In this unit, we will cover the following topics. We will begin with definitions of these terms to describe exactly what they mean. We will then talk about why there are concerns about privacy and security related to health information. We will then look at tools for protecting health information, and finally we will discuss the HIPAA regulations, the privacy rule, the security rule, what additions have been made to HIPAA with the high-tech legislation, and just the general implications of HIPAA.
Well, let's begin with definitions. If we're going to talk about these topics, it's important that we use them in their correct meaning. It's important to distinguish between privacy and confidentiality. Privacy is your right to keep things to yourself, your ability not to have to disclose private things about yourself. Confidentiality, on the other hand, is your right to keep things about you from being disclosed to other people. So you vest confidentiality in a physician, in a healthcare system, and you, by doing that, expect them to not disclose information about yourself to others, to keep it confidential. Security is the activity of protecting your personal information, typically in electronic information systems, but there is a whole series of issues related to paper-based information and security, although we don't think about it as much, and we'll talk about that topic. Individually identifiable health information is any data that can be correlated with an individual. So something in a medical record, something in some sort of database somewhere that can be linked up to an individual as individually identifiable health information. A related term is personal health information. This is individually identifiable health information as defined explicitly by the HIPAA privacy rule in the United States. Finally, the last term to define is consent. And consent is actually a broader term, but we'll define it here in the context of privacy. When you give consent to the healthcare system, you're giving them written or verbal permission to allow use of your individually identifiable health information for the activity of providing you healthcare, or you're participating in a research project or something like that. You give that consent explicitly. In the remainder of this segment, we will talk about concerns about privacy and then concerns about security, then moving on to tools for protecting security and HIPAA in following segments. We'll focus first on concerns about privacy. We'll discuss this notion of personal privacy versus the common good. We'll talk about disclosures of personal health information. We'll look at some of the concerns that the public has about privacy of health information, and then we'll make a few comments about de-identified data. Well, let's start with talking about the notion of personal privacy versus the common good. There truly is a spectrum of views here, oftentimes reflecting one's underlying political beliefs. At one end of the spectrum is the view that while personal privacy is important, and I don't think anyone anywhere in this spectrum would think that it's not, there are some instances when the common good of society outweighs personal privacy. An example that's often given is biosurveillance, whether it's emerging natural diseases or things like bioterrorism. we can intervene in the response to these threats earlier when we have more information. Another example is clinical research. If the more we're able to do clinical research, the better our ability to provide health care. The other end of the spectrum holds that personal privacy trumps everything, that there should really be no reason to violate one's privacy without explicit consent. And some of the organizations that are prominent in promoting this point of view are the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, who has written specifically about medical information, even though they deal with broader privacy rights topics. And then another group called patientprivacyrights.org, headed by Dr. Deborah Peel, a Texas psychiatrist who is very well known and outspoken in personal privacy. Some of the concerns that these individuals rightly have are well demonstrated in a video that was produced in 2004 by the American Civil Liberties Union, which the link is provided to, and you can go watch it, and you'll see how the pizza restaurant has access to their medical information. They penalize them for ordering extra cheese because their cholesterol level has shown to be high and so forth. It's a video worth watching, even though it takes a very specific point of view. Others have called for a more balanced approach between personal privacy and the common good. Two good articulations of that are from the California Healthcare Foundation and the American College of Physicians, both documents worth looking at if you're interested in this topic. And then, of course, your views fit somewhere on this spectrum. As with many ethical issues, there are no explicit right or wrong answers, and you have to decide where you fit, and our political process will determine how we balance these. Well, no matter where your views fall on that spectrum, there are continued patient information disclosures, and it's important to know about them and to prevent them from happening in the future. Let's look at some examples and related issues. There have certainly been disclosures when information ends up getting put on the open internet, so it is then picked up by various applications, including, probably most importantly, the Google search engine. So if information about individuals gets put onto web pages, Google, in its efforts to index the entire World Wide Web, will pick up those pages, and then people can find them by searching. Google, of course, picks up anything that's out there, unless you explicitly tell it not to, and it also picks up database query forms, and those databases may not be as well protected as they should be, which is another way that information gets disclosed. There are many, many stories of information disclosures. Whenever I update this slide, I have to get rid of some of the older ones to put the more newer or egregious ones. One that is particularly egregious happened in my own city, in Portland, Oregon, where on New Year's Eve, some individual left in his car a bunch of discs and backup tapes and other media that had records of about 365,000 patients who were seen by a visiting nurse association. This naturally got a lot of press and demonstrated that you need to be careful and not, for example, leave things sitting in view in your car, especially if they contain personal health information. The Veterans Administration system has had a number of episodes, probably the largest of which was a laptop with data of over 1 million veterans that was stolen. The laptop was recovered, and it appeared that the data was not accessed, but of course, no one knows exactly what went on with the machine when it was in the hands of those who stole it. HIMSS Analytics has looked at various aspects of disclosure. They believe, or this report believes, that aggregated data in hospitals and healthcare facilities are the richest source of information, which can also be used for fraud and abuse, and they document exposure of over 1.5 million names in 2006-2007. As we'll talk about more when we get to HIPAA, the HITECH Act increases the penalties and requirements of the HIPAA legislation, and now any breach, any disclosure of information of over 500 individuals must be publicly reported both on the Department of Health and Human Services website as well as to local media. And if you go to this page, you can actually scroll, and it's quite a list of all the 500 plus person breaches that have occurred. You can see there that this is a recurrent problem. Well, many healthcare organizations are not well prepared for security. Until recently, protecting information was not a major thrust of what they do. They're more focused on delivering healthcare. But as the healthcare they deliver requires electronic systems, they obviously need to beef up their security. A report by Deloitte, the consulting firm, looked at security issues in healthcare organizations and came to the following conclusions. One is that the primary threat of information is data leakage, that is, data that gets out in the routine care of patients. The report also concluded that identity and access management is a top priority. The trend towards outsourcing of IT in these organizations raises many third-party security concerns. Most healthcare organizations, particularly large ones, must have something like a chief information security officer or chief security officer, and the role of this individual takes on greater significance. Every decision about information systems needs to be assessed from the standpoint of security. This report also found that despite the security environment becoming more complex and the amount of regulations continuing to grow, that financially strapped healthcare organizations were not keeping pace in their budgets for security. Another report by HIMSS reached roughly the same conclusions. Healthcare organizations are just in general not keeping pace with security threats and readiness for them. And of course, technology can worsen the problem. Dr. Adam Wright, when he was pursuing his PhD at OHSU, did a small but widely cited study where he showed that the USB drives that we commonly plug into our laptops, sometimes called thumb drives, which run a program to enable their use when they're plugged into a computer, that program can be modified to then extract data from the computer. And so if that computer has personal health information on it, the thumb drive can basically copy it off the computer. There are many people who have developed personal health record systems based on tools like Microsoft Access, which has some encryption functionality, but is very easily compromised, so information can potentially be accessed that way. Another interesting analysis found that 10% of hard drives sold by a secondhand retailer in Canada were found to have remnants of personal health information on them. When we dispose of computers, we don't often completely wipe clean the hard drive, and so the next user may have information that's accessible on those drives if someone knows how to get to it. Well, one question to ask is, what is the role of governments in protecting privacy and confidentiality? We'll start by looking at the United States and then moving to other countries. In the United States, the Government Accountability Office has criticized the government, the U.S. government, for its inaction in protecting data in its own health-related systems and also developing policy for protecting that data. NCVHS has weighed in over the years on a number of privacy and security issues. In 2006, they released a set of recommendations, 26 in all, for policies concerning health privacy for the Nationwide Health Information Network. They further released recommendations for personal control of health information and again called for a consistent and coherent policy. Another activity has been the HISPC effort, the Health Information Security and Privacy Collaboration, a project funded by the government that looked at 42 states and territories and assessed their various approaches and laws to privacy. They found a wide range of privacy approaches and laws and conclude that this makes nationwide approaches difficult because of these sometimes conflicting laws, and there probably needs to be more harmonization of privacy laws, especially as we develop health information exchanges that move personal health information across state lines. The Department of Health and Human Services did release a nationwide privacy and security framework in 2008, and it covered the topics listed here: individual access, correction of information, openness and transparency, individual choice about who gets access to what information, some of the limitations on collection, use, and disclosure of information, data quality and integrity, safeguards and accountability. Not surprisingly, depending on where you are on that personal privacy versus the common good spectrum, some people believe that the framework did not go far enough. To continue this discussion going, the Department of Health and Human Services has now laid out an approach to identifying stakeholders with regards to preferences for access and exchange of personal health data, and then developing policy around that. Well, the United States is not the only government that has been addressing privacy. In fact, the European Commission has devoted even more efforts to protect individual privacy. Their directive, 9546EC, has a set of pretty stringent rules and essentially allow data processing only with consent or in some highly specific circumstances, such as a legal obligation or what they define as a public necessity, usually revolving around public health. The countries that implement this directive provide examples for how consent around information can be used for efforts in the United States in the Nationwide Health Information Network. Well, this is certainly not just a government activity. There are actually a number of related issues for medical privacy. one of these issues, and again, there's no right or wrong answer here, is who owns medical information? As the articles by Hall and Rodwin point out, historically, whoever owned the medium that the information was put on was considered to be the owner. So if you had a office practice or a hospital and had paper charts, you bought and owned the paper, so it was presumed you owned the information on that paper. However, in the electronic era, information freely moves across networks from one system to another. It becomes a little less clear whether the person whose physical medium that the information is sitting on truly owns it. And in fact, the growing view is that the patient owns their information. And of course, there, as the amount of this information increases, there becomes economic value to it, to health systems, pharmaceutical companies, and others who may want to use that data for various purposes. And the article by Rodwin in particular argues that when there is an economic advantage gained by that information, that at least some of it should be shared back with the patient. Another concern is compelled disclosures of information. That is, even though our laws and regulations may highly protect information, we oftentimes compel individuals to disclose information, and sometimes for non-clinical care reasons in the healthcare setting. So we need to keep an eye out for not requiring individuals to disclose information that's not really being used for health-related activities. Another growing issue concerns the genome. We'll talk about bioinformatics more in Unit 10, but the genome may be one's ultimate personal identifier. We talked about personal identifiers in a previous unit, but your genome is what makes you an individual. The individual genes and the variation that you have from others unequivocally is unique to you and identifies you from others. We may try to de-identify health information, but with genomic information, even when the clinical data is de-identified, we may easily be able to identify an individual if we have access to their genomic information. And this manifests itself in a number of ways. For example, we can identify a person's genome by the genomic information in their siblings. There's a lot of genomic information that's going to be the same. As we will discuss further in Unit 10, there are these growing number of genome-wide association studies where we attempt to associate variation in an individual's genome with different diseases. And there is actually a requirement for researchers to put this data in public databanks, although usually the individual personal information is protected, but for a researcher who can legitimately get to that information, it is not too difficult to identify who the individual is from that data. So as we move forward with genomics and personalized medicine, the privacy issues will come to the fore. We also have a public that's concerned about privacy. Two surveys done in 2005 ask individuals to weigh the benefits between electronic health records and privacy risks. Certainly, most people are concerned about sensitive health information, although people still want electronic health records. They want to be able to track their own information. The second of these studies also found that consumers were generally unfamiliar with HIPAA, even though most of them have signed things like notice of privacy practices and the like. Some organizations have tried to develop a set of rights with regards to information. The American Health Information Management Association has developed its Health Information Bill of Rights. This includes rights such as being able to access your health information free of charge and during the course of your treatment, the right to expect that the information is as accurate and complete as possible. You or a personal representative should be able to know who provides, accesses, or updates your information, except in some circumstances when precluded by law or regulation. You should have the right to expect that the healthcare system will be held accountable for your information and any violations will be prosecuted appropriately. You should expect that protections will be made available, will be applied to your information, no matter where your care occurs. And finally, that you have some private legal recourse in the event that your information is disclosed, especially when it causes harm. Another approach to protecting individuals' health information, more in the context of personal health records, comes from a coalition called healthdatarights.org, which is mainly comprised of companies who produce electronic health records and personal health records, such as Microsoft and Google. Oftentimes you hear about data being de-identified. That is, we remove the personally identifying characteristics of data, such as name or address or some of the other fields that make up personal health information. Well, it turns out that de-identified data isn't always as secure as we may think. One researcher who has brought this to light and has received notice in the popular press is Dr. LaTanya Sweeney. When she was completing her PhD, she did a widely cited study that essentially identified William Weld, who was the governor of Massachusetts at the time, from linking up two publicly available data sources. Her research also showed that 87% of the U.S. population could be uniquely identified by their five-digit zip code, gender, and date of birth. So when we start to combine relatively common data elements, we can quickly get to individuals. So the case of William Weld was that she was able to access a health insurance database for state employees, and Governor Weld was obviously a state employee, and she was also able to purchase the voter registration list for the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he lived. And she then combined these two databases, linking up the zip code, gender, and date of birth, and was actually able to identify Governor Weld, as I'll demonstrate further in the next slide. But again, we've already talked about genomic data that can aid re-identification in clinical research studies, and some recent research that showed how social security numbers of individuals can be predicted from public data because so many data sets have social security numbers. This slide demonstrates how Governor Weld was de-identified. So on the left is the so-called de-identified state employee health database, which had things like state employees' ethnicity, visits to healthcare providers, diagnosis, procedures, medication, and charges. It also had their zip code, date of birth, and gender. The Cambridge voter registration database had name, address, date registered, party affiliation, and the same zip code, date of birth, and gender. So Governor Weld was one of those 87% who had a unique combination of zip code, date of birth, and gender. So Dr. Sweeney was able to take his voter registration information and then access his entire medical information. And this was picked up by the national media and at the time caused quite a stir. Let's look at concerns that people have about security. One of the ways to protect privacy is to make information more secure. So what concerns do people have about security? In the following slides, we'll look at the many points of leakage of the system. We'll remember that this is a problem for paper too. It's not unique for electronic systems. We'll talk about some of the consequences of poor security, and then a related topic of medical identity theft. So as anyone who works in a healthcare setting knows, there are many points that information can leak out of the system. This figure from Rindfleisch shows how information flows through the healthcare system. It's generated in the provision of patient care by healthcare providers in clinics and hospitals. Information then flows to healthcare support activity, so payers of healthcare, the insurance companies that reimburse, quality reviews, as we increasingly measure the quality of care delivered, and other types of administration. There are also what Rindfleisch describes as social uses of information, everything from insurance eligibility to reporting to public health authorities and using data in medical research. And although it is regulated now by HIPAA more so than when this figure was published, there are commercial uses of information, things like marketing, things like participating in managed care organizations that may use data for various purposes to try to improve the quality or efficiency of the care they deliver, and also monitoring of drug usage. So any points along the way, information can leak out of the system. It's always important to remember that even though the concerns about privacy and security are heightened with electronic systems, that paper records have their own set of privacy and security problems. In fact, some have argued that they may be more prone to breaches of security and disclosure. So unlike electronic systems, it is very difficult to audit the trail of a paper chart. We just don't know where the chart goes, who's looked at it. Unlike most electronic systems that will record at least which login has looked at a particular piece of information. We also have issues with fax machines. Even in this electronic era, we still rely on fax to move information around. The paper comes out of fax machines and sits there in a basket, and people can come up and look at the piece of paper. We don't know where it necessarily goes. Records continue to be copied, photocopied, for many reasons. Patient goes to a new provider. The insurance company needs to have documentation that a specific procedure was done or referral was made. And records get abstracted by individual people, whether they're paper or electronic, for things like research or quality insurance. And most healthcare insurers belong to something called the Health Information Bureau, which monitors for insurance fraud. And they have developed a huge database of individuals and healthcare claims looking very appropriately for health insurance fraud, but being a source of information, of quite a bit of information, on the individual's personal health. Well, what are the consequences of poor security? Well, as Rindfleisch pointed out in the late 90s, patients do various things to protect their security. They avoid seeking health care. They lie so things won't end up in their charts. healthcare providers have concerns about security, so they may avoid entering sensitive data that could be important in the care of that patient by others. And they also devise workarounds to entering that information. The California Healthcare Foundation, its survey of consumers found that 13% engaged in activity that they called privacy protective. And these were activities that might put their health at risk, such as asking a doctor to lie about a diagnosis for whatever reason, the insurance company or wanting to keep someone from knowing that they have a certain diagnosis. They also may pay for a test out of pocket because they don't want to submit a claim. Because when a claim is submitted, then the insurance company knows that the test was done. And they may even do things like avoid seeing their regular doctor for some problems because they are trying to protect their privacy over some piece of information. A final security concern is medical identity theft. And this is a growing concern, especially as more information is available electronically. And it emanates from the problem that we have in society of general identity theft. But medical identity theft is defined as the use of individually identifiable health information for obtaining access to property or services. When this happens, the victims are not only individuals who have various things become part of their medical record, but also health providers, health plans, and really even society at large that pays for health care. So there are many victims of medical identity theft. And AHIMA has determined that the value of medical identity information is much higher than just the kinds of things that people use for identity theft, like a social security number. And the Department of Health and Human Services has also addressed this problem and developed a report that outlines various approaches to prevention, detection, and remediation of medical identity theft.